Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. The Islamic State, also known as ISIS, emerged from the remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. It's a local offshoot of Al-Qaeda founded by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in 2004. It faded into semi-obscurity for several years after the surge of U.S. troops to Iraq in 2007, before re-emerging in 2011. Over the next 5 years, it took advantage of growing instability in the Middle East to carry out attacks and bolster its ranks. In December 2018, then-President Donald Trump declared victory over ISIS. But from their standpoint, the group is in no way defeated, and since toppling the Western-backed government in Afghanistan in August, Taliban leaders have ruled out cooperating with the United States to contain extremist groups like this one, even amid signs of increasing terrorist activity, including a bombing at a mosque reported on NPR just this morning. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seawort, and we welcome listeners of the West Side. Since emerging in eastern Afghanistan in 2014, ISIS has carried out relentless attacks on the country's Shiites. It is also seen as the terror group that poses perhaps the greatest threat to the U.S. for its potential to stage attacks on American targets. But this is just one facet of a decades-long conflict brewing in the Middle East, where groups have formed and fragmented with different ideologies seeking control and power. But who are they, and what do they want? Wausau native Anne Speckard, PhD, is an adjunct associate professor of psychiatry at Georgetown University in the School of Medicine and director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism. There, she heads the Breaking the ISIS Brand, ISIS Defectors Counter-Narrative Project. In her work, Anne has written many books, including Talking to Terrorists and Bride of ISIS. She was also co-author of ISIS Defectors, Inside Stories of the Terrorist Caliphate. One of the world's top experts on international terrorism, Anne has interviewed 500 or more terrorists, their family members, and supporters in various parts of the world. Anne, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you for having me, Shireen, and hi to my hometown.
Yes.
Wausau, Wisconsin.
Listeners with questions for our guests can certainly join the conversation. You can call us at 800-780-9742 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. So, Anne, I have so many questions for you, but before we get into all of that, I'm really curious what drew you to this work. How did you get involved in this?
I blame my husband. He made U.S. ambassador, and I gave up my counseling practice. I had a thriving private practice, and I was doing some research, and he wanted to go overseas to be an ambassador. So we went to Minsk, Belarus, and I shut everything down, and I had to reinvent myself. So in Belarus, I studied Holocaust survivors, Chernobyl liquidators, all kinds of trauma things. And then we went to Brussels, to NATO, and ultimately we ended up in Athens, Greece, which was wonderful. But we were overseas for a lot of years, and during that time, 9/11 happened, and I started studying terrorists. And being a psychologist and always using the in-depth interview method, I started interviewing terrorists and have now interviewed over 800 of them and have branched into talking to white supremacists as well. And wow. I got hooked and I couldn't stop.
Wow. So interesting. So interesting. Well, tell us a little bit about the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism. What is that exactly?
Okay. We're a small think tank and we're researchers. We call ourselves action-based researchers, meaning that everything we do, we want it to have a real world effect. We don't just want to stay in the ivory tower. So, basically, we were stood up in 2015. We got our first grant from the U.S. State Department, and that is the time when ISIS was all over the internet recruiting. And the State Department talked to me about, okay, you've done these 400 interviews, you've really studied terrorist groups in depth, you've looked at trajectories into and back out of terrorism. What about if you started filming your interviews or went back and filmed people you have interviewed? Could you make any kind of product that could go on the internet to fight back against ISIS, which became the Breaking the ISIS brand? And their idea was maybe go talk to people who I'd written about, like Mubin Sheikh. He brought down the Toronto 19 group, Toronto 18, I think it is. Sorry, I forget how many they were.
Sure.
And people that had maybe not been terrorists, but that I knew. or going back to Al-Qaeda? And I said, no, it needs to be ISIS. If you want to counter message ISIS, you need ISIS insiders. But I didn't know if I could reach to ISIS insiders. And I managed to do it through the help of a policeman in southern Turkey who knew the smugglers. And so our first interviews, we did 32 interviews. I did them with Ahmet Yala. And that was our first book, ISIS Defectors, together. And we talked to Syrians that had run away from ISIS, had been in the group but run away, and were willing to tell us why they didn't like ISIS and to speak against the group. And then we got first a Hollywood filmmaker to make our first two videos. We've now made 250 videos, and they're all ISIS insiders or Al-Shabaab insiders and now white supremacist insiders, telling why they got into the group, what their grievances were, what their motivations were, and then how it actually went in the group, and denouncing it. In the case of ISIS, saying it's un-Islamic, it's brutal, it's corrupt. Don't think, brother or sister, that you're coming to something that's following Islam. It's not. Don't join. You'll just destroy your life, as I have. In the case of white supremacists, a little bit different.
So where did ISIS come from? Who started this? Who led it? Where did it all begin?
Well, all terrorism begins with people having some form of bad governance and grievances. And, you know, you can go way back to Egypt, where people were being repressed and Sayyid Qutb and writing in prison and ultimately dying in prison, saying, you know, this is a repressive regime. We have to use our religion to fight against it. And then Al-Qaeda coming up in Afghanistan and countries like Saudi and Yemen saying, go and fight jihad there. We don't want you here, and hoping they never come back. And then in Iraq, when we invaded Iraq, Zarqawi came in and started Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which ultimately split into two groups, Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And the groups moved into Syria when they saw their opportunity during the Arab Spring. And ISIS was so successful because they suddenly declared a caliphate and called to foreigners all over the world, you must come to the caliphate, you must come. And this afforded them 40,000 people that came, many of them that were forced or enticed into being fighters. And the people didn't even speak Arabic, so ISIS could say, go attack that village over there, they're all Shia. And they might not even be Shia, which would have been the enemy. And or, you know, that's the Assad regime. And, you know, it might have just been a competing tribe, and which it was in some cases. And so they had this massive fighting force. And when they were able to stand up a state, they looked legitimate. So people all over the world became convinced, wow, there's an Islamic state. It looks like it might be the end times. We need to go there. We need to follow our religion and live this way.
So what exactly are they fighting for?
Well, Islamic State is fighting for the idea of creating a Muslim caliphate in that particular region and then spreading it throughout the world. And their ideology is Muslims are under attack by the West. And in Islam, there is this thought process that if someone stops you from practicing your religion, if they make it so that you cannot pray, you have a right to fight back. Or if you are attacked, if your state is attacked, you have a right to fight back. You have a call to fight back, an obligation. But these groups claim that they are under attack, even though they're practicing terrorism, so of course they're under attack. And they'll make claims like, okay, you live in the UK, you live in Belgium, don't you see how you're suffering prejudice and discrimination? So you're not allowed to follow your religion. This state is your enemy, which is totally not Islamic, doesn't follow, you know, the true teachings, which even it probably our religion says, well, I'm assuming that I'm talking to a mostly Christian audience, that of course we have the right to self-defense.
You've used the word caliphate a couple of times. Can you explain for listeners what that is? What does that mean?
Well, it's there were a number of caliphates in the history of Islam, and it's an Islamic state that's set up to follow Sharia, and Sharia is Islamic law, although the listener should understand, I think there's 14 or 15 different schools of Sharia. So there's not one. And ISIS claimed that they were the true followers of Islam, and they follow this practice called takfir, which means I can say to you, Shireen, if the two of us are Muslims, well, you're not following ISIS, so therefore I takfir you, and I can kill you, even though you're a Muslim. And this is also totally against Islam, because you're not allowed to kill other Muslims, which is one of the reasons that we've seen things like Naid al-Hassan, who was a U.S. soldier and psychiatrist, who ended up doing an insider attack against the U.S. forces because he was so torn by the idea of going to Afghanistan and fighting Muslims, because he felt that that was wrong, but, you know, did another wrong to try to right it.
Sure. I think for a layperson, it can be tempting to kind of lump all of these groups together. But there are differences. So what distinguishes the Taliban, for example, from ISIS and other groups?
Well, Taliban is a local thing. So Taliban exists in Afghanistan. And ISIS is a terrorist group that's international. And I wouldn't even call the Taliban a terrorist group, necessarily. I mean, it's an Afghani movement, political group. And I'm not an expert on Afghanistan, so I should, you know, I can tell you what's going to happen probably with what we're seeing now. But they're totally two different things. And ISIS is a follow-on from Al-Qaeda. Al-Shabaab is related. All of these terrorist groups are related in the sense that they started locally, but then they went international. So Al-Qaeda fought in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda fought in Chechnya, they brought the Chechens into an international jihad. ISIS brought people from 110 countries into an international jihad, and they declared war in all the places that they did terrorist attacks, which are almost every capital. New York City had an ISIS attack. Orlando had an ISIS attack. London had numerous ISIS attacks, Brussels. So we don't see the Taliban doing anything like that. Although the Taliban did give a home to Al-Qaeda when they were in Afghanistan.
How is ISIS different from ISIS-K? We're seeing ISIS-K and ISIL. Are they all the same, or are there distinct differences between those groups as well?
Well, ISIS has tried to create a global presence. So they have what they call wilayats, or divisions around the world, and they also get people to swear allegiance to them. And ISIS-K is just their group based in Afghanistan and in that region. And it's growing now, and it's of great concern because ISIS-K has us in their sights, where the Taliban wanted us to leave Afghanistan. But, you know, they weren't looking to attack us in New York City, where ISIS-K definitely would attack us anywhere they could find us in the world, because they're related to the larger organization of ISIS. And it's a lot of times the same people. And we're now seeing people that were formerly migrating to Syria and people that were in Syria inside ISIS going to Afghanistan at this point. So that's very concerning, because wherever you have turmoil or failed states, it makes a good nest for terrorists, which is exactly the way it was for Al-Qaeda when they nested themselves with the Taliban. So the Taliban was not Al-Qaeda and was not necessarily terrorist, but Al-Qaeda definitely in global terrorists.
You're listening to WASA native Ann Speckard. She is director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism. Our guest today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on the rise, the spread, and fall of the Islamic State. When we return, we'll learn more about Ann's interviews with hundreds of terrorists and what their stories can tell us. Your questions and comments are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shireen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward, welcoming listeners of the West Side. Wausau native Anne Specker, director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism, is our guest today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on international terrorism and its reach into the United States. What would you like to know? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or join by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. And many of the people that you interviewed are women who are actively involved in terrorist activities. I think some of us in the Western world probably have a difficult time understanding why women are drawn to groups that, in many cases, as we see it, limit their rights and diminish their stature. So what draws these women in?
Well, I always say terrorism is very contextual and it's very individual on some levels, but there's four things that make a terrorist. There's always a group, except in very rare cases. There's an ideology, and the group's there because, you know, there has to be something to belong to. There has to be an ideology. There has to be someone organizing things. It's a political thing. And then the ideology itself, which makes people jump over a moral barrier and be willing to attack civilians, which is usually the definition of terrorism, although there's 500 different definitions of terrorism. And then there's some kind of social support of this is okay and you can join it. And social support these days is very easily offered through forming groups on the internet. So you might not have anybody in your immediate community that supports you joining a terrorist group, but you might end up in a group, like you said, you're on Slack, where you have 50 people talking to you every day saying, brother, this is a great idea. You should go explode the shopping mall in your town, and we can tell you how to do it. And then the fourth thing is your individual motivations and vulnerabilities. And when we look at women, those tend to be similar to men, but also different than men. One of them is wanting to belong to something, wanting to feel a sense of dignity, purpose, significance. For many women, it's if they're living a conservative Islamic lifestyle in a Western nation, they may be suffering this tension between, you know, people spit on me when I wear a niqab or even a hijab. They try to pull it off my head. They say insults to me about my religion. And I can't stand it anymore. And here's this Islamic State that stood up and is promising to be a place where I can practice Islam and I can do so in a dignified manner and I can serve my religion, not really taking into account that this is a brutal terrorist organization. Or they might fall in love. I mean, men and women joined ISIS because they were wanting to get married to someone that was calling them. A lot of them got married over the internet and, you know, went expecting for their spouse to pick them up and to live in marital bliss. And some did have short-lived marital bliss until the bombs started falling all around them and that they saw that ISIS didn't allow you to leave as freely as you came. In fact, you could get killed or put in prison and tortured if you tried to leave, which was a big surprise to many. And women were also surprised that when they arrived across the Syrian border, they were immediately put into a madafa, which is a guest house. They were separated from their husbands. Their husbands were taken to take weapons training and Sharia training. Sharia training is Islamic law, ISIS's version, of course. And they were separated sometimes up to a month and lived in squalid, locked up, like imprisoned, basically. And the women were very shocked by this and said, oh my God, I realize I've entered something that's totalitarian. I didn't expect this. I was expecting to live by Islamic precepts and have a good life. But then their husbands came to pick them up. They set up a house in whatever town they lived in, usually Raqqa, Tabqa. And their husbands would come and go, fight 2 weeks, come home 2 weeks. And many of them said in the beginning it was a good life. They were afforded apartments, payments, food, things that they needed. And they lived normal Syrian lives. And but then, you know, over time they saw, I'm living under a totalitarian state and the ISIS Emni can come and pick me or my husband up at any time. We have no rights. And this isn't Islamic at all.
Before the program, you were telling me about an example of a Western woman who joined. Why do you think some Westerners are drawn to this as well?
Well, I was telling you the case of Hoda Mathana, who was born in New Jersey and grew up in the U.S., but her family was Yemeni. So she was caught between these two realities of, I'm a Muslim woman, but I'm also grown up in the West, and what does that mean? And when her father allowed her to have a phone, which was a bit late, I think 17 or 18, she immediately got on Twitter. And at that time, there were many Muslims calling for people to go join the caliphate. And she got sucked into it and said she already had a religious belief in heaven and hell. And they started convincing her that if you didn't follow the call to the caliphate and you didn't go and live there, that you would burn in hell eternally. And she said she thought that this was her duty and she should go. She also had personal reasons for wanting to leave her family. And she decided to go on a grand adventure. And at first she liked it. But over time, she got disillusioned, as most do, and now desperately wants to come home. She's had a little child. And when I interviewed her in Camp Roche, her little child was really sick. And this is the issue with all of these people kept in the camps. The children have committed no crimes. I mean, are you really afraid of a three-year-old that they're going to pick up a Kalashnikov and try to shoot you? And, you know, what was their crime? That their mother brought them to ISIS, or that their mother got pregnant and bore them in Syria? So the children for sure should be brought home. And there's grandparents very willing to take this child. And
well, you mentioned Twitter in this instance, and you talked about the internet as well. How big a role has the internet and social media played in kind of ramping up terrorist activities and getting people recruited?
The internet played a huge role. And I shouldn't say the internet, I should say social media companies, because it used to be, I remember when I was studying Nordost, which is when the Chechens took over the Moscow theater. I think it was 2002. They actually made a film of themselves, which they put on a videotape, and it was delivered to Al Jazeera, and Al Jazeera played it. And then the whole world saw what was going on in the theater and what the demands of the terrorists were. So terrorists used to have to work with people like you. They had to get a journalist to broadcast whatever it was they were doing and what their demands were, and maybe something about the group. And, you know, that's news. So journalists played along. But not anymore. When social media came along, suddenly terrorists just needed to set up their accounts, just like you and me, and they can broadcast for themselves. And in fact, if they can grab a journalist like James Foley and behead him, it will go all over the media everywhere. All they have to do is, you know, put their film of it on social media, and they could also interact with people in real time. So it became something where terrorist groups could blanket all the social media, so Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, which came later, whatever it happens to be, and they still do this, blanket it with a call, and then they just sit back and see who responds. So, you know, there's millions and millions of people seeing their propaganda, and maybe two or three respond with like or share or a comment, and then they immediately hone in on that person. So there's a case of a girl in London, I think she was only 13, she started following ISIS people on Twitter because she was fascinated by them. And the amazing thing is, hundreds of them followed her back. So suddenly she had this large Twitter following, which, you know, all 13-year-old girls are concerned with popularity. And they started telling her, you should come to Raqqa, you're a Muslim. This is the caliphate. And sending her pictures of beautiful mansions and swimming pools and saying, you should get married. And she's like, I'm only 13. And they, oh, well, you don't have to get married the first minute you come here. But luckily someone intervened in her case. And she said to the people that intervened, you know, my idea was that it was some kind of Islamic Disneyland, and it would be wonderful to go there. So I've been involved in cases, both the prosecution and the defense of ISIS returnees. And sometimes it really bothers me when an ISIS a person that joined ISIS is accused of being naive and having blocked out what was in the news for all of us to see, like the beheading of James Foley, things like that, and that they couldn't possibly have known that ISIS was not a brutal organization. But my question always is, well, where were they seeing all the positive propaganda of ISIS? They were seeing it on Facebook. They were seeing it on Twitter. So if you're going to hold this individual person to that standard, why aren't you holding Facebook and Twitter to the same standard? Because shouldn't they have known also? And shouldn't all of that have been removed from their platform so that there was no possibility to interact with it?
That is very interesting. I'm curious about the interviews you've done. You've interviewed hundreds of people. And what are you hearing from them? Have you found any common themes that that emerge as you're doing these interviews?
What I find is that people have grievances and they also have dreams. So ISIS portrayed itself as a utopian state. And everybody, when they have problems in their lives, dreams about escaping and going somewhere else where they leave all the bad and go to the good. Usually when people do these geographic locations, they leave a lot of good and they take their bad with them. And ISIS is no different. So we have a case that Dutch police told me about. They said she came back, a returnee, a teenager, and her mother had been a prostitute. She had joined a lot of different groups that had nothing, no ideology like ISIS. And ISIS was just the latest flavor of the month. And they called her to Syria. So she went to Turkey, crossed the border, as everybody does. And she explained to the police as a teenager that as she was running across the border, because that's what you do, you run across the border and the ISIS guys meet you on the other side, that she felt like all her problems were going off her shoulders. And she's just leaving it all behind and she was going to utopia. And of course she was going to hell. And everything was horrible and it was horrible for her to finally escape. Her life is probably ruined. She was facing the possibility of prosecution once she got home. But people go dreaming that their problems will be solved. And as a state, ISIS was offering a salary, an apartment, the possibility to get married, or people actually did get married over the internet. The possibility, they were claiming that you can live an Islamic life. They were claiming that you could get a job, that you could get training. So I interviewed a woman from Belgium that her husband broke up with her, left her with a young boy, and she put up a Facebook profile that was a little bit more conservative Islamic, and the ISIS recruiters pulled her in and said, sister, we'll find you a real Muslim, one that won't abandon his family. Come to Brussels and we'll meet. And she did, and they introduced her to somebody. The two of them flew to Italy and then took a cruise ship over to Turkey and probably had a wonderful honeymoon, and then crossed Turkey, got into Syria, and then it turned to hell. And she realized that she wanted out, and they had promised her, we'll train you to be a nurse, which they did no such thing. Your child will go to school. Actually, her child, she was terrified that they were going to take him to the cubs of the caliphate. He was a boy. And she was trying to get out. Her first attempt, she got arrested and put under house arrest. Her second attempt, she made it. Back out, she had convinced her husband to escape as well. And her husband went to prison. Her kids were removed from her. And luckily, she got her kids back, got a stay of prison sentence. And she now goes around Belgium lecturing to high school kids, don't believe what you read on the internet. Don't believe people you meet that make promises to you, because I did, and look what happened to me.
How hard is it to get out?
Oh, it's really hard to get out, especially for women. Well, you know, it's different. That's why it's all contextual. Women wear niqabs in ISIS, so it was easier in that sense that if you're a white woman and you don't look like a Syrian, your niqab will save you in some ways, because when you pass checkpoints, if you're passing with a man, no one would dare ask for you to lift your niqab. But you need identity documents, you need permission from ISIS to cross checkpoints. So if you don't have that, you'd be stopped at a checkpoint and they'd say, why are you traveling? And so there's another case of a woman from Belgium that told me the first time that they manage, you have to pay a smuggler to help you. They managed to raise the money, pay a smuggler, but the smuggler was corrupt and turned them right back over to ISIS. So took their money, probably was paid by ISIS as well. And they were all arrested. They were put in prison. Her husband was tortured. Her father was tortured. And she had a little baby. And she was back home. Her husband was still in prison, being tortured. And her father said, "We need to try again. And your husband will be able to get out easier without you and the baby. So come with us now, and he'll follow." They went their second time. The thing, when you got arrested a first time for escaping, oftentimes they made you sign a document in blood that you agreed that ISIS had the right to execute you because you were a traitor to the state. So they got arrested the second time at a checkpoint, and her father just started walking away because he knew the next thing was he's going to be put in prison and executed. And the ISIS guys shot them in the back. And her carrying an infant, she was shot in the back, took bullets with an infant in her arms. So one of the things that I say when people were afraid to bring her home to Belgium, because I talked to the Belgian authorities about she needs to be brought home. She was pregnant again at that point. This is a woman that is never going to serve ISIS. They killed her father in front of her eyes. They shot her when she had a baby in her arms. She was trying to leave repeatedly. And, finally did ended up in Camp Al-Roj, arrested by the Syrian Democratic Forces. But do you really believe that she's ever going to be a threat to us serving ISIS? I doubt it.
Do most of the people that you've interviewed who have gotten out express remorse? Do they feel bad or about what they've done? Or do they still feel conflicted in some way?
That's an interesting question. The conflict is, do they give up Islam? Very rarely. I talked to one woman that had been a Christian and converted to Islam, has now gone back to Christianity and said, "I don't want anything to do with Islam anymore." I also talked to a man from, I think it was Finland, that said, "I don't want to be a believer anymore." But that's really rare because, think of anybody that loves their religion and was raised in it. They still love their religion, but they see that this is a group that hijacked it and used it for bad. A lot of them will say, "I'm not an Islamic scholar, so I don't really know the basis to answer this or that question." Like if I ask them about the Yazidi slaves who were raped and sold, they'll say, "I know that does exist in Islam, the idea that your captives are your slaves and you can use them as you wish. I think it was horribly wrong, but I'm not a scholar, so I can't comment on that." Which means that they would really benefit from a scholar talking to them. But do they regret? Almost all of them. And I call this spontaneous de-radicalization, that they got disillusioned. One woman said to me, "I don't need a de-radicalization program. I just, ISIS was the best program that ever could be because they were so corrupt. They de-radicalized me."
You are listening to Route 51 with Wausau native Anne Specker, director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism. When we return, we'll talk about the challenges the U.S. is facing, and we'll talk about conditions in the camps where many ISIS militants are being held. Your questions and comments are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org. I'm Shireen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward, welcoming listeners from the West Side. Anne Speckard, Wausau native who is one of the world's top experts on terrorism, is our guest today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on ISIS and other extremist groups. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@WPR.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. And tell us about the camps where many ISIS militants are being held. What are conditions like there? And how many people are in captivity? Do you have a sense of that?
Oh, I don't have the numbers right on the top of my head, but I think it's like 10,000 foreign fighters are in the camps. And I might be wrong on the numbers, sorry. But they're terrible. They're just these tents that the UN provides. When the rain comes and they get real heavy on the tent collapses and all the cold rain pours into the living space. Some of them have heaters, little portable heaters, but the people live in these tents, and there are some really nasty ISIS people in both of the camps, and these are ISIS enforcers, ISIS Hizbah, which is the morality police, women that still believe that the caliphate is going to come back, that the fighters, who are still in the same numbers they were when ISIS originally took power, in Syria and Iraq, that they're going to come and attack the camp and liberate the women and bring them back to wherever ISIS is hiding out now. So if you take off your headscarf, if you speak against ISIS, if you give an interview to people like us and we create a counter-narrative video of you and your identity is known, they will come and punish you. So what they do is they're all cooking for themselves in these camps. So they have knives, they have kerosene, and they'll come and put a bottle of kerosene and a knife in your tent, which is a message of, we're going to kill you. We're going to burn your tent. And if you persist, they do burn your tent, and women and children have been burned up alive in their tents, or they stab you. In Camp Al-Hol, there was a murder every other week for a while, and it's really scary. And in Camp Al-Hol, these ISIS women, again on the internet, again on social media, mostly on Instagram and Telegram, were raising money and offering single and widowed women to be brides. And European men who have money would say, oh, that's really cool. I'll take her as my second wife, and I'll support ISIS because I think this is a good thing. And they send money to the woman. And so now she has money to buy additional groceries compared to the pretty lean provisions that the camp provides. And if she gets enough money, she can smuggle herself out of the camp. So we were seeing women smuggled out of the camp and children. And mostly, some of them made it home to Europe, but a lot of them went to Idlib, and we don't know what they're doing now, which is really scary. And Camp Al-Roj is not as bad as Al-Hol, but there's disease that goes through the camps. They have COVID just like we do, but they also had other diseases that women and children died of. The summertime, it gets so hot. It gets over 100 degrees. There's no air conditioning. The dust from the area swirls around in dust clouds. So I tend to get reactive asthma, and little kids there will get asthma, bronchitis, respiratory diseases. More than one mother told me, my child turns blue, stops breathing. I can't get medicine. There's not a good emergency reaction team here. So children die, and they don't have, the children don't have toys. It's just rocks strewn on the ground. When I stopped in one town, and in Syria they have, you know, like these markets, and they had all these balls in a bag, like kickball balls. And I stopped in that village, and I bought every sack of balls that I could buy. I came with, I don't know, 20 balls, and gave them to the camp authorities and said, please hand these out to the kids. And I always bring candy when I come to and hand it out to the kids, because it's just dire. And no child deserves that. And we need to think about, they're being subjected on a daily basis to ISIS enforcers, ISIS ideologues, and hopefully the mothers are protecting that them from that. But one of our military people has said, you know, if we don't get these kids out of the camp, they're the next generation. We're going to be on the battleground because they've been rejected. They've been subjected to ideologues. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if they will be the next generation of ISIS. They may just be lost kids, but it is terrible.
We had an email from Ken in Holcomb who asks a question that I think is on many people's minds. He was wondering, how much harder do you think it will be to monitor ISIS and other groups in Afghanistan now that American troops are no longer there? Do you expect a terrorist act in the U.S. in the near future, for example?
Well, I always expect that it's not hard for a group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda or you know, whatever new group comes along, to mount an attack because they've managed to convince very many Europeans who have visa waivers to join them. And they've managed to convince Americans to join them. And all anybody needs to do if they want to mount an attack here is go to a rifle sale and pick up enough guns and show up at a shopping mall. They can do something like the Eastgate shopping mall attack in Kenya and murder a lot of people, get on the television, and you know, it looks good for them. So it's really a terrifying thought. And thank God our FBI is very good and follows these people. But what I've been told is now that social media companies did crack down, that's a good thing. But there's always the terrorist groups running ahead of you and morphing and adjusting their methods to whatever your counter methods are. And they've gone to encrypted sites. So you used to be able to follow somebody that was following ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, now ISIS-K, on social media. But now they start there because they're still there. They just aren't broadcasting the same way they used to. It's more hidden. And as soon as they get you, they take you to Telegram. And it's really hard to follow on Telegram.
And why do they hate us so much?
It's that they want what they don't have. And basically, they want the same things as us. They want freedom. They want to live a good life. And they're living under repressive regimes. I mean, the people in Afghanistan, it's three generations of trauma and war. And, you know, if you're living in Afghanistan, our troops weren't necessarily seen as a good thing. And if you get sucked into this mentality that ISIS is teaching, the West is at war with Islam and with Islamic people and doing unjust acts. So they're convinced that they're in a war of self-defense. And they want the same things we want, but they want to follow their religion. And if they really get sucked into ISIS, then they want a Sharia state. And but, you know, it's interesting when you start talking to people about that. If I just did this in prisons in an undisclosed location, I had an Islamic scholar with me. And when we started asking, my scholar would ask, "Brother, what ayah are you following? What hadith did you base that on?" And these people couldn't even speak Arabic. They didn't know their religion that well. And they would say, and he'd recited in Arabic perfectly, beautifully, and then recited again in its English translation and say, "Do you know the meaning of that? Do you know the context of that? Do you understand that the way you've interpreted that is completely wrong? And actually, if you were following your logic, you would talk fear of the Prophet, or you would talk fear of Caliph Omar, who the Prophet said was in paradise. So which one is right, the Prophet or you?" And these guys had kind of turned white, and but they'd also sit on the edge of their chair and really listen to him because he's an authority, and they want to follow Islam. So they're just sucked into a virulent ideology and given a hope that things can change that are wrong in their lives. They are in many cases, deprived of opportunities, frustrated, have real grievances, are suffering discrimination, marginalization, living under corrupt and repressive authoritarian states, and they don't like it, just as we wouldn't like it. But they think that the U.S. and Western powers are behind this, when in fact it's their own corrupt politicians that need to be changed. And they don't need to do what they're doing to change it. And it's one way to try, but it's never going to work.
For the people that have been sucked into this, what's the most effective tool to discredit ISIS and this ideology? Is it using the voices of disillusioned ISIS cadres? Or how do you change minds? How do you pull them out?
Well, first of all, you have to reach minds. So we created the Breaking the ISIS Brand Counter-Narrative Project to speak to the grievances that the people that were going into ISIS were also feeling. So we started all our videos with this is what I was experiencing and this is what I didn't like about what I was living right now, or this is what I wanted to escape, which might have been family problems. And this is why I thought ISIS was a good solution to those problems. And then when I got there, it wasn't. It wasn't even Islamic. And it was horrible. So we call that breaking the ISIS brand, because it's, you know, meeting somebody where they are. And we always name our videos names that sound. And you can, if you want to go listen to a lot of ISIS videos, you can go on our YouTube channel, ICSVE YouTube, and follow our playlist in whatever language you want to follow it. And you can listen to ISIS insiders tell their story. But we always name them the Glorious Cubs of the Caliphate. We show a ISIS a thumbnail, because we want to reach those people that ISIS is reaching and pull them in, because you can't change any mind if you don't find some common ground with that mind, and then show them this is not the answer to your grievances. And then we developed this thing called the realjihad.org website. And now we invite people to go to the website so that they can read writings from our Islamic Sheikh. They can go much more in depth. They can find places to redirect them to better things. Because there's nothing wrong with wanting to address corruption, grievances, discrimination. That's all good stuff. But addressing it by believing that ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab are your answers is the thing that we're trying to address. And same thing, we just worked in the prisons. And what I find is treating people with dignity, with love, addressing them. I mean, when I sat down with these prisoners, they said, "Are you here to find out if I'm an extremist? Am I on a list?" And I just laughed and I said, "Well, are you an extremist? And is there a list? And if there's a list, what does it mean if you're on the list? What will happen to you?" And immediately they heard care. And they opened up and they said, "Well, you know, we know that there's this list being created and we're worried about it. And I think I'm going to be put in solitary. I don't want to be put in solitary," and on and on. And then I said, "Tell me about yourself." I mean, of course, I asked permission for the research interview, but then tell me about yourself. "Oh, you were a heroin addict and the brothers got you off of heroin? Mashallah, that is amazing. Your religion is really powerful. That is so cool. You know, it's really hard to get off of heroin, but what are you having to pay for that treatment program that you went through in the prison that the brothers are running? And is this good for you? And tell me about this form of Islam that you're following." And then I brought in the Sheikh, because he was sitting beside me, and said, "Let's ask our Sheikh, Sheikh Ali, let's ask him." And then he said, "Brother, what ayah are you following?" And we would laugh with them when we would see them turn white, when they realized, maybe I don't have this right. And he can speak Arabic and he's a scholar and he knows his religion inside and out. He's got the highest hijaza from his country. And maybe I'm wrong. And it shakes him up. But on the other hand, we left. We didn't offer them anything to address their grievances, which is they have long prison sentences. They got into heroin in a country that didn't warn them that heroin is addictive, that didn't give them a treatment program. The extremists gave them the treatment program. Prison conditions are really bad. The extremists give them phones, money, support their families. You have to interrupt all of that, and you have to offer from the good side something good, along with a good interpretation of Islam, and maybe you'll pull them out of it. But if the extremists are offering something better than you're offering, why wouldn't they go to that?
We have about a minute left, and I have to wonder, with the U.S. now entirely out of Afghanistan and so much unrest, with everything you know, is there a path forward for peace?
Well, the path forward is keep working on good governance. Don't allow failed states to be nests for terrorists to live in. You know, keep intel going as best you can, and it is much harder when we have our troops out. But there's positive and negatives to having our troops out. Now we don't have the footprint. Now we're not the ones blamed. We still can do drone attacks. We can still do special forces. I mean, this is a problem that you have to come at from 1,000 different directions. There's not one simple, easy thing. But the best thing you can do is build good governance and for people to have good lives so that terrorists aren't attractive to them.
Thank you so much. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert, glad to have listeners of the West Side along for the ride today. I'd like to thank our guest, Ann Speckard. Our producers today are Kate Spranger and Joy Ratchkramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route51. Next week, we'll learn all about cheese, including an effort underway to name Colby as Wisconsin's official cheese. And in 2 weeks, we'll share a special encore production celebrating the unique connection between the Green Bay Packers and the people of Wisconsin. Until then, we're heading out of town. Yeah.